Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Jay Michaels at the Passion Pit Podcast, first one of 2019. Now, it might not be snowing outside, but let me tell you, there's a flurry of arts and entertainment out there this month, starting the new year. There are, I can't even tell you how many shows opening up in the first month of the year. We have New York Winterfest, we have Planet Connections, we have things at the ATA. Oh, so much going on. So enough of me, and let's get right to the interviews. Planet Connections Theater Festivity, in partnership with the Theater at 14th Street Y, presents a powerful new play written by Glory Cadigan and directed by Broadway veteran Tanya Pinkins. A granddaughter bonds with her grandfather as she helps him confront the regrets of his youth in this riveting new play. We've had the opportunity now to speak to Tanya Pinkins about Till We Meet Again.
Hey, Jay.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
Not bad. If I'm on the line, you're on the air.
Oh, well, who am I on the air with?
Just me. This is being recorded. Thanks to the miracle of editing, we can we just plug it right into the program.
All right, we're on the air.
There you go. To our listeners, this is Tanya Pinkins, who is a very popular name and very respected name within within the arts, both in independent theater and commercial. It is a pleasure to have you on the phone. You are highly spoken of amongst people like Bob Oost and needless to say, Glory Cadigan. Tell our listeners about yourself.
Well, I'm from Chicago, and I've been doing theater, gosh, for the last 40 years. I've been a professional actress.
That's great. It's a shock, right? You suddenly hear a thing like 40 years, and you go, "Oh my gosh!" And it shocks you for a minute. Time flies.
Yeah. Well, it's been 40 years. I started doing like industrial films and commercials for McDonald's and Coca-Cola in Chicago, and then I did my first play at the Goodman Theater when I was 16. The world premiere of Juan A. Soginka's Death and the King's Horseman, and then that went to the Kennedy Center when I was in high school.
Wow.
And then I got my first Broadway show when I was in my freshman year over Christmas break.
Oh.
I was cast in Merrily We Roll Along with Hal Prince and Steve Sondheim.
The original. You were in the original.
The original Merrily We Roll Along.
Oh my gosh. I'm now intimidated. Wow.
Yeah, so you know, I've done a few things.
You were also on All My Children, yes?
I was on All My Children, but before that, I was on As the World Turns and Heather Dalton. And I was one of the kids with Marissa Tomei, Julianne Moore, Stephen Weber, and what's her name? Betsy. What was Betsy's name? You know, she was married to Dennis Quaid. Why can't I think of her name right now?
Oh, my gosh.
Actress. She was in Harry Met Sally.
I'm drawing a blank.
Meg Ryan.
Yes.
Meg Ryan. So me, Meg Ryan, Marissa Tomei, Julianne Moore, and Stephen Weber were the kids on As the World Turns.
Oh, my gosh. That's amazing.
And, yeah.
And here you are. You are still navigating the shark-infested waters that is the American theater.
Yes.
And you are the project we're talking about now, you are directing Glory Cadigan's new play, Till We Meet Again.
Yes, and excited to be.
This is not your first foray into directing either.
It is not. I directed a trilogy opera company in Newark this year. I directed Paul Rose in the opera, and earlier this year before that I directed at Black Spectrum Theater. I directed Bring It On the Musical. I've directed many places, some short plays and also short films, and I'm actually in training right now to direct for television.
That's, oh my goodness, the intimidation factor on my end of the line keeps growing.
No.
So you to call you an expert is to putting it mildly. To call you a connoisseur would also be to put it mildly. What do you look for?
I like that world.
Isn't that a nice word? What do you look for in a project when you say, I want to act in this, I want to direct in this, I want to be part of this? What do you look for? What must hit you about the piece?
I want to feel like I'm learning something new and I'm having to stretch myself and I might fail.
That's excellent. That's excellent. Well, that's right there. What do you feel you're learning from this play? What's the learning quotient within this one?
It's not a traditional play. It's the journey that the audience has to go on has to be very carefully calibrated and directing the actors. And if I can succeed at it, it should leave the audience just and talking and thinking and wanting to come back again to see what they missed or how did they not catch that. So it's in the La Mama experimental style, but it's a thriller, it's comedy, it's a dramedy, it's got all that going on. History, feminism, the war, yeah.
What's it about? What's it about? You're tantalizing me even more. What's it about?
Well, it's about all those things I just told you, but we find out about all those things through the lens of a family, where the mother, the matriarch, made choices that her daughter made very differently, and the granddaughter, of course, is looking between them and trying to figure out what to do. The father, who was a surgeon, is in the war, and he's confronting his regrets and memories of a woman he knew in the war who is also a very different kind of woman.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a man who is in search for a lost person in his life, and these people's paths cross and converge in funny and violent ways.
Wow. Okay. This play sounds like it can span many demographics. Obviously, talking about the war, etc. Do you think everyone can come away with something for this? Is this something where the millennials will walk away educated, and yet an old fogey like me will also walk away transfixed from it? Do you think it touches every voice, every person?
I think it's a play for all families, all ages. We have an 11-year-old who is. Maybe you might say the character who takes us through the entire play, the story of the play. And and there's a lot of history because the little girl is learning and asking questions and writing reports and looking in the encyclopedia. So she's learning about the world that she lives in. And then the people in her family are sort of enacting aspects of the world and what causes war around her.
That's very powerful. So not only are we seeing the documented, if you will, the historic levels in terms of war, we're seeing it very personally through through the family's eyes. That's excellent. A lot of pieces are taking that flavor now. It's no longer about what we're reading in the encyclopedia alone. It's about what it did to our neighbor. We're seeing it, unfortunately, politically so much in the news. So this is really a powerful and very timely piece. Which is great.
Yes.
One curveball thing for our listeners here. How has it changed? Now we're in a world right now where I'm seeing where the female voice is getting louder and louder and more powerful and more respected about time. What's it like to be a woman navigating the arts from the good old days to now? What have you seen in terms of changes, good and bad?
Well, it's interesting that you say that because a new documentary just came out called Half the Picture about women directors in film. And one of the things that you're seeing the top women directors, and they're saying it's actually getting worse. Even though there's an EEOC has filed charges, and women directors actually suffered a setback in television last year. But women are going to keep making the work. And Gloria and I are actually working on another piece together called Truth and Reconciliation of Women, which are plays by and about women on the ways women oppress each other and the modeling how we heal that and consolidate to become the powerful force that we can be in the world. So that's going to be at the Y in July.
Oh, that's great.
And also at the hashtag HealMeToo Festival in March and April.
Oh, that's terrific.
Now,
I have seen your name many times connected to Planet Connections and Glory Cadogan. Tell us about your relationship. Tell us about the working with Glory and the profitability, if you will, from your connection with her and vice versa.
Well, Gloria and I met when she invited me to direct a play of Gina Taylor's for their Planet Connections festival gala at the end of the season. Mm-hmm. And we just kind of hit it off and began hanging out in a more social way together. And she and I have gone to readings of many of her plays. And then we started working on Till We Meet Again and had a reading last year at the La Mama Umbria Festival here in New York. And that was when the opportunity to have a full production at the Y came up. So I think I came onto this play when she was at draft 1.8, and we're now at draft 4.1. In the meantime, I told her that I was interested in creating some things. So I asked her to write a play for this Truth and Reconciliation of Women festival that we are having, and we had a performance at Deepak Home Base. So, you know, we've become friends and colleagues and mutual appreciation and admiration.
That's great. That's great. What's last question, because it sounds like there's a million people around you, and I'm not going to take too much of your time. What's next for you? You've given us the list of this year thus far. What's in the future? What do you, not so much, you know, oh, I'm doing this play, but what do you hope to achieve? Where are you in a year, in 5 years, et cetera? What are you hoping to achieve? Your mission?
That's so funny. I'm always looking to grow, and I actually tried to join this new economic work for women thing that was going to train me to be a union plumber or electrician or carpenter. And I was rejected because when they asked me that question, where do you see yourself in 5 years? I said, I'm going to be the boss. And they were like, the boss of what? I said, whatever I'm doing in 5 years, I'm going to be boss of it. And it was like, that was not the right answer. So next year I'm actually working on a film that I'm writing, directing, and starring in. So we're going to go down and shoot that in the Caribbean. As I said, I'm shadowing, directing on Fear of the Walking Dead. Because I'm a DC villain, I'm Ethel Peabody, and I was a villain on Fear of the Walking Dead. I've been invited to do some Comic-Cons, so I'm going to probably go to Germany and some other places to do some Comic-Con stuff. And Truth and Reconciliation of Women is, I have four different productions going up next year, so coordinating designers and directors and new plays and musical pieces. And getting it published and having it done all over the world, that's going to take a lot of time.
Indeed. Okay, my inner child is coming out because I'm a comic book geek and a horror movie fan. Are you a fan of genre films like Fear the Walking Dead and Comic-Con? Is this like a big thing for you?
Oh, yes. Well, I've only done about three Comic-Cons so far. But doing Ethel Peabody on Gotham was just so much fun. And then on Fear the Walking Dead, I got to kill a lot of people.
Oh, that's
great.
There was
one episode where before the credits, I like killed 8 or 9 people.
Oh, that's exquisite. Oh, my gosh. Okay, well, now I have to go back to that show and look. And I have to watch it again and again for you.
Season 4. I am the villain.
Oh, that's great. Oh, that's wonderful. Well, now I'm thoroughly intimidated by your theatrical work, and now even my inner child is now sitting here giggling. This has been absolutely wonderful. I will tell our fans and listeners exactly where to see the show, how to find out more about you and your work. This has been wonderful. Thank you so much for your time, and
you,
here's to a wonderful new year, and looking forward to the show.
Thank you so much, Jay. Have a
Thank
good
you.
Evening.
Ciao.
Thank you, Tanya. A therapy session with myself. This full-length, semi-autobiographical drama by playwright Anthony J. Piccioni talks about the inner struggles of living with mental illness and Asperger's syndrome. It's premiering at the Hudson Guild Theater. And now we have an opportunity to speak to its playwright, Anthony J. Piccioni.
Hello.
Anthony J. Piccioni.
How are you, Jay?
Good. This is Jay Michaels. If I'm on the line, you're on the air. How's it going?
It's going good. I am having a pretty good day. I earlier today was at rehearsal for my show, and we're just starting to add, like, sound effects and projections to the acting and stuff like that. So it's really coming together. And
oh,
I'm
very cool.
Excited about that.
Tell us about the show. Tell us, give us the elevator story about the production we're going to go see.
Of course. So A Therapy Session with Myself is a semi-autobiographical drama and my first full-length play we produced in New York. I know I've had a ton of one-act produced over the past year or two, but this is my first proper evening of theater all to myself. So.
That's great. That's great.
And, yeah, it is. And it's about a young man suffering from social anxiety, depression, and Asperger syndrome, all things that I've had to deal with in my own life. And it kind of focuses on real-life memories that were from my high school and college years. And it takes place the summer before the senior year of college of the character who's based on me. And he's in his apartment, and he gets a visit from a human incarnation of the second half of his inner consciousness. We call him, quote, you in the play.
Wow.
And so it's like a back and forth between the two, and they're trying to figure out, like, can they actually overcome some pretty traumatic events from their past and overcome his anxiety, and the rest of the story is told through flashbacks in a non-chronological order. I always say I want this play to feel more like a stream of consciousness more than a play with more than a story, I'm sorry, with a beginning, middle, and end. So, you know, I hope it maybe starts a conversation about issues of mental health and autism awareness, because I think there's a lot of stereotypes still surrounding those topics, and, you know, I hope people can see it, and we'll see what happens.
Okay, so here's the big question for you. You're a little different than a lot of the playwrights I'm dealing with in this, because what you've done a little bit like August Wilson has done. He's created these series of characters and this what they're like each generation. And what you've sort of done is taken yourself and any obstacle you've had in life, like you said, these are issues you've dealt with, and you've turned them into mm-hmm. plays. All your one acts have that same theme within them. It's like here is a mental illness, here is a social illness, here is something that is stopping you in some way, and you're sort of going through your own therapy, if you will, on stage. What prompted you to do that? What prompted you to say, okay, I am now going to help myself by showing myself to all these audiences? What prompted you to do this?
Oh God, I've loved writing itself since I was 7 years old. So that's before I can remember having any sort of problems like that. But, you know, since I was in high school, whether it was like short stories or poetry and stuff like that, which was not that good, trust me, you don't want to read that. Because it was high school, so, you know. But, you know, then later on, as I got older, I was originally an actor, and then I started dabbling in playwriting, first as a hobby, and then when I got to college, I started taking it seriously as something I could do as a career, so to speak. And, you know, for me, I want to write about things that I care most about, and that I have some sort of connection. There's the whole saying that you should write what you know. Like, sometimes you should challenge yourself as a writer. Sometimes you should challenge yourself as a writer and try and go other ways, and I'll probably do that later in my career, not in the not-too-distant future. But, you know, with this play, with What I Left Behind, which was produced last year, with a few of my other plays, you know, these are things that I've have lots of real life experience with, and I just want to show people what it might be like to deal with it, because I still think there's a lot of misunderstanding. And also, I think for people who maybe have gone through with these things, I want to show people, especially with this play, that there's hope. Like, I don't want to give anything away about the play, but, you know, I think one of the messages of this play is if you're willing to go out and give people a chance again, even after a lot of really shitty things you've had to go through in life, then you'll find that life kind of is worth living. So, I don't know if that answers your question or not. But
how do you feel about life now? You have now, just as memory serves, you must have had about a half a dozen one acts circulating New York in the last couple of years. And now you have this first full length, and you're like a known name now. Now, when someone says Anthony Piccioni, no one goes who. They go, oh yeah, I saw that play. I saw that play. Oh yeah, I heard about that. You're also a prominent reviewer, so there are those that, right. that utter your name in total terror. How do you feel about life now? Has putting these issues on stage helped you? Do you feel like a better person for, you know, you've sat there in the audience and watched actors basically portray things that you felt inside. How does it feel for you now? Do you feel better about yourself? Do you feel you have still a way to go? What's in your head now from watching you on stage?
I mean, there's a lot that I could say to that, but, you know, I don't want to lie and say that I'm feeling like totally happy about every little scene in life. Because I feel like I'd be lying, frankly. Like, part of having depression and a mood disorder like I have means that you're kind of all over the place in your mind. I think that'll be reflected in this play.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, obviously, compared to like when I was in high school, when I was being bullied on a regular basis and like wearing all black clothing and stuff like that, I was one of those kids.
Uh-oh.
You know?
Though black is very fashionable, I'm told.
Well, thank you. I think so too, but.
Yeah.
Obviously, as an adult, I'm definitely in a better place today. I'm in a place now where I can focus on the creative project that I've wanted to work on for a long time now. I have, I think, a group of go-to artists, including a few of the people who I'm working on this show with, who I can rely on and who I'm becoming friends with. And, you know, obviously, there's stuff I like to make better about my life. There are certain goals I have career-wise that I still like to advance. Like, I'm still thinking like 3 or 4 years ahead, if not longer, about the productions I'll be doing after this one. Like, I'm already writing my next full-length play, and I'm writing some one acts that I hope will be produced in 2020. And I might be dabbling in film soon, but that might be getting a little carried away with myself, but because I know we're supposed to be talking about this play in particular, but...
Nope, we're talking about you. That's... We know you got a show going up, and I'll tell our listeners when it is, but we're talking about you, man.
So, yeah, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, life is complicated is kind of what I've learned the older I've gotten. But, yeah, I'm definitely in a way better place. I'm very, very, very grateful to be here in New York and to have had 7, soon to be 8 plays produced here. And be working with lots of incredible artists from around the world on these projects. And yeah.
So it seems that this has become, for lack of a better term, pardon the pun, this has become therapeutic for you to express yourself via play. Do you endorse others to do that? Let's say someone has an issue. Do you think it helps them? Do you think it empowers them to put it on paper, to write a poem, to write a play, to write a movie, to write whatever, but right. those feelings to put on paper for others to hear?
Definitely. It's helped me. I mean, like, you know, obviously I don't want to tell other people like how they should cope exactly. Like, cause you know, other people might have different means of coping, but yeah, definitely. Especially if you're in the arts, then it definitely helped me to write down what I've been thinking or feeling about certain topics, whether it was mental health issues I'm going through or, you know, something I'm seeing in the news or the world or whatever, and like what I'm thinking and feeling about that. Like, it's definitely a very cathartic thing, and it's definitely helped me cope with lots of things. So, and I, you know, I'm not the first artist to find a means of therapy through that. So by any means, but I definitely won't be the last, I think.
How about your audiences? We always hear these stories of people coming over and saying, this guy came to me and says I'm transformed. This woman says I'm crying. Have you had that same kind of thing? Have audience members come to you and say, thank you so much, I feel better about myself, or thank you for putting this out there for others to see? Have you touched audiences? I know your reviews are marvelous. So now, how has John Q. Public been about your plays?
Well, some of them. With What I Left Behind, my one act last year, for those listening who might not know what that is, there was definitely a big reaction to that. And
that was a very powerful piece. That was about a suicide. That was about the aftermath of a suicide, yes?
It was about teen suicide It got a great review from Dorian Colombo that year, and now it's published with JAC Publishing and Promotions. So, you know, if anyone listening is looking for a short one-act play to produce, I'm there. Go look it up. But, you know, that's one example. And, you know, there are others, too, like, of people who told me that they really loved my work. But that's probably one of the more memorable examples. Honestly, though, with already with this play, like, it's not the production yet, but there have been some people who have read it, who I'm close with, who've already told me, like, that they think it's going to resonate with people. And we say, if they've had experiences with people who are on the autism spectrum, for example, like if they're parents of people who are dealing with that, or parents of people who maybe have, like, let's say bipolar disorder or some other mental illness, they've told me that this is a play that has really helped them and they thought was beautiful. Like, it sounds weird for me to say that about my own work, because, like, to say that, oh, my play is beautiful, because I'm not saying it, like, I don't mean to say it like a narcissistic way or anything like that, but like...
You're quoting, so there you go.
So yeah, I'm just saying, like, I'm just quoting or paraphrasing what other people have said. Like, I'm definitely quoting at least a few cases, but, you know, it's obviously very humbling to hear that, and, you know, I don't want to, like, jinx anything, because we still have a world premiere coming up next month, and
right.
I hope everything goes great with that. But, you know, so far, the reaction to the play itself and the reaction to the rehearsals from the people involved has been very positive. So
That's great. You're doing a great service. You're not just putting something up there to make people laugh, though making people laugh is the best medicine.
Sometimes I do that. Some of my plays have. Like, Ebola Rama and Two Cousins and a Pizza are the names of my two other published plays. And those are... If people are looking for a more ha-ha, that's funny type of play from yours truly, they can go look at those. So,
how's it feel to be published? Last question. How's it feel to be published? A lot of authors I know are like, oh, this is the next step.
Feels awesome. It's like, you know, it's kind of the culmination of what you expect for any play.
Do you feel validated? You know, do you feel like, okay, now it's a real play or something like that?
Well, it's probably was a real play before, but, you know, it's definitely... It has, you have in the back of your mind that, you know, there's a possibility that your play will live on, that will hopefully keep getting produced. So, like, maybe 50, 100 years from now, people will go and look up random plays and be like, oh, I wonder what this play is about. Oh, this is What I Left Behind. This is Therapy Session with Myself by Anthony J. Piccioni. That was like, so, you know, there's always that possibility, and that's very cool. So, you know, it's always nice to just be produced even one time in the first place. But, you know, publication is amazing, and I'm very grateful for that. And I hope people go maybe see those published plays, because they're online for sale right now. I hope people come see A Therapy Session with Myself, and go to www.anthonyjpiccioni.com for more.
This is an author I know for many years named Luigi Januzzi, and my company produced one of his plays once, and I got a phone call from him, and he said, this is wonderful, I'm coming down and see it, it's published, and now you're doing it, yay! And he was just so thrilled. So I'm so happy to hear that seems to be the validation. As I'm sure you know, in Greek drama, the only reason that the plays survived was because they won festivals and contests. So there were thousands of Greek plays, but we only have a certain few that won contests. So there you go, you're up there with Mr. Euripides.
I've never thought of it that way before, but that makes me feel even better. So
well, in 1,000 years, when someone teaches theater, they're going to pick up books of published plays, and you're going to be there.
That's my dream. I'm going to be totally honest and say that's my dream.
There you go. I'm going to say the one thing which you don't have is shyness. You have put your website during this call. You have mentioned every play. You've done everything but said you'd stand outside in front of the theater selling tickets yourself. So I give you a lot of credit for the guts that you have and that what you're doing. I think what you're doing is amazing. I think it's helping people. And
can I just say one more thing on that, actually?
Of course you can.
Yeah, because I remember my first short play produced in New York. It was at Manhattan Rep called The End of the Line at the End. I was grateful at the time that my first play produced there, but there were only like 4 or 5 people per night in the audience. And I think me and my mom were among them. And so I you know, so I have mixed feelings about that. But since then, I've made a vow to myself, like, I was never going to let that happen again. And, you know, it's like, I think you'd be the first person out of anyone in the theater industry that I know of to say, like, don't be shy, promote your work all you can. So I've been trying to take that advice to heart. And hopefully we'll see how much it works come January.
You have done it like a doctor. You scream your works to the highest rafter. That alone should be an example to every young playwright out there. Anthony, thank you so much. It was wonderful speaking to you. I look forward to the show. I look forward to your next show and the next 50 shows that you're going to do.
thank you, Jay. And I hope you and Mary have a happy holiday and a happy new year.
Thank you. Same to you. Enjoy the holiday. Enjoy some rest. And then give them hell in January.
Thank you. Nice talking to you, Jay.
Thanks, pal. I'll talk to you soon. Ciao.
See you. Bye.
Anthony Piccioni's play will be part of New York Winterfest, which is an ongoing series of new works done at the Hudson Guild Theater. And when it's not winter, there's the New York Summerfest. And we'll talk about that when the weather gets warmer. Further at the Winterfest, we have two more entries to chat with. One is Max Berry. He'll be on the line shortly. And next week, we will chat with Jan Ewing about his play, Nursery Rhymes. But in the meanwhile, we're climbing the treehouse of dreams, where we're reliving old memories and defining moments in Max Berry's parable of friendship and confronting very powerful feelings. His play opens Monday, January 7, right on top of us. So enough of me. Let's hear from Max.
Hello?
Max Berry.
Yes, hello.
This is Jay Michaels. If I'm on the line, you're on the air. How are you?
Awesome. I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Not bad, not bad. Getting ready for 2019.
Yes.
And at the top of 2019 is your play, Treehouse of Dreams.
Yes, yeah.
Congratulations. You're like a featured event in New York Winterfest. Congratulations, young playwright. Congratulations.
Thank you. Tell me
about the show. Tell our listeners about your show.
Sure. So Treehouse of Dreams is a, it's a show that centers a lot around these three friends, Winston, Scout, and Mark. And in the classic vein of teenage friend groups, Mark and Scout have been dating for years, and then Winston has always been in love with Scout. And so then the play kind of kicks off with Scout and Winston sleeping together in Scout's treehouse.
Uh-huh.
And so then, like, so then Scout and Winston immediately freak out, and they don't want to hurt their friend. And so Scout decides to run off to California, and Winston's just like, I'm going to go off to college in New York, and we're not going to really have to think about this anymore, not have to really deal with this or tell Mark or confront it. And that's the plan. And then they're just like, great, we're going to go our separate ways. Well, while they're off in New York and California, Mark dies in a car accident.
Wow.
And so then they're forced to come back to that small town where they never thought they'd see each other again, still with these feelings, and now with these feelings of guilt. And kind of the play centers around the question of, is it moral to still pursue these feelings under these new circumstances of this death and Mark never having been able to know that this is what happened.
Now, you have a little twist in terms of the casting of this, yes?
Yes. We cast Winston, who was originally written as a male, as a female, and the actress does a wonderful job. Honestly, it only makes the play better in my eyes.
So we have two women having an affair. And one of them is dating a fellow student who's a man, and then they say, okay, I'm not going to deal with this anymore, and they disappear, and they come back years later upon the death of that boyfriend, and there they are staring at each other.
Yes. Well, it is them coming back takes place only like several months after the initial, they're sleeping together in the treehouse. So it is a very youth centric, they're all still very young characters.
Oh, wow. So so the feelings are still raw. The feelings are still right out in front. It's not like
very much so.
Wow. Okay. That's an interesting twist. A lot of times you hear about these romances within a scholastic environment, and suddenly it's 20 years later, they come back and they have a whole life behind them. You're basically, you're saying they're dealing with it while it's still fresh in their brains and hearts.
Yeah. And I think with that, something that's really important in this play, and something that I know Brooke, the director, has really been trying to emphasize too, is just that the youth of these characters, and that they all want to know what's going on and know how to deal with these things, but they really don't. And just kind of like dealing with probably a lot of, like, for Scott and Winston, if not the first major loss of their life, one of the very first, and certainly the first of their age. And just how to deal with that on top of these feelings of just love and friendship and romance, and how all of those are a lot scarier and more emphasized when you're younger, when you don't really 100% understand those feelings yet. So that's a real big part of the play too, is the youth of these characters.
Indeed. Let's even focus on that for a minute, with the notion of a homosexual or bisexual relationship goes back to before Tennessee Williams. So something, this kind of plot is memorable to theatergoers for that reason. But you're taking it from the millennial point of view. This is one of the first times I'm hearing of this sensibility done via the millennial thought process. How do you think it differs when you're a younger person today in the 21st century, when being gay is not the crime that it was, if you will, during the days of Tennessee Williams, that it's so much more personal? How do you think it changes? How do you think the audience will digest this?
Well, I think that one of the big things with that is that we don't have to make it, for lack of a better way of phrasing this, we don't have to like make it about that, in a sense of like, not that that's necessarily a bad thing to make it about that, but I think that like they're just people, and that by kind of not making, like, writing the play around the fact that it is two women, and just, you know, having the script is just as it is, and it just happens to be we cast a woman, we can really just, it's really just that idea of just like, we're all people, and it doesn't matter, you know, someone who loves someone of the same sex is just as valid, and their feelings and thoughts and emotions are just as valid as someone who likes someone of the opposite sex.
If anything, you're making it stronger, it seems. Go on. I'm sorry.
Yes.
What were you saying? You said you had spoken to...
Oh, I was just saying, I've spoken to several friends, who do identify as homosexual and bisexual. And one of the things, when I was talking to them about this and the direction they were taking the show, that they had said is that they do really, they store the times that where they really, the stories that they really love are the ones where they're telling this story and the characters just happen to be homosexual or bisexual.
That's
if that
great.
Makes sense.
That's great. I was going to say you're taking it from a very personal point of view. We're hearing about the feelings of these people. It's not it's not the message of, oh, well, this is important too, et cetera. You're not making a preachy statement. You're letting us enjoy the love story, whatever that happens to be.
Yeah.
That is really good. What made you write it? What made you say, okay, and then what made you decide the characters should both be women? It's interesting because we have an author who literally took his play and then said, you know what? I'm going to do this to it. So you essentially took your play and then rewrote it, changing the whole thought process. What went through your mind? What was your reasoning for it?
So the thought was presented to me by Brooke, the director. And being perfectly honest, at first I was a little, just because, you know, you write your play and you see it in your head how it is when you write it down.
Sure, exactly.
And so the first, like, the split second instinct is to go, oh, but wait, that's not what I wrote. But then if I've learned anything, it's to just sit back and just see what happens. And I, the more I thought about it, I was like, no, this will only help the story. The kind of relationships that then are being created, are, like you said, from such a millennial perspective by casting Winston as female. Something, an unintentional side effect that I noticed that I loved that happened from the casting was that with Winston and Mark, we are now seeing a totally platonic male-female relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That is this best friend relationship that I identify very strongly with because I have several very, very close, totally platonic female friends. And I think especially in every sort of story, it's very rare do you see that kind of thing without even a hint of like, ooh, maybe they'll get together. Even the ones that end up being just friends by the end, there was a moment, for some reason, they feel like there always needs to be a moment where they're together. And so I think for me, it was just kind of sitting back and just letting the play become what it needed to become and just hearing thoughts and ideas from people and actors and things and just being like, you know what? Yeah, this is the story that I'm telling. This is the story that I want to tell. And I think that we're through casting Winston how he did, I think we're definitely telling that story.
Now you're very open. You've written a piece and it has since changed and you're very open to this, which is amazing. Do you think this is a new way that playwrights are thinking? Because I'm sorry, I got boots that aren't even millennial that are older than that. So I come from the world where an author is going to say, no, this is what I wrote. You can't change it. Do you think this is what you're saying is sort of like, are you being progressive? I have an expression. Are you an accidental genius or a genius on purpose? Are you creating the concept that a play is that much more of a parable, that these are the words, but the words must be able to change even immediately to get a message across? Do you think that's a new way of thinking, that plays could be so organic?
I definitely think that a play could be that way. I think that I certainly, you know, I'm going to go and after these performances of Treehouse and sit down and be like, okay, well, from these performances and from what I saw, what now can I add to the script or how can I adjust things? I think that I'm still experimenting with and still learning. Because it's a very fine line for me. When the line between allowing for art to happen and standing up for a certain part of one's work, I think so far that I've done a pretty good job of determining which is which. I have yet to have a situation where I have to say, no, I think this needs to stay as it is. Because usually the people that I'm working with are so smart and are so, like, they want the piece to work and to be as good as it can be. And so usually when I am getting these kind of suggestions and feedback from people, it's never just like a quick thing. You know, those things that we discuss and talk about. And I think that's one of the amazing things about playwriting that differentiates it from like a novel. You know, once you write a novel and you're done with the novel and you publish the novel, it is done. Sure, they release like special editions, like 10th anniversary edition, but for the most part, it is done. That is what it is. A play, you write it and like it needs to be performed. So inevitably, there's going to be things that are going to change and evolve from the moment the script is done in air quotes, to the moment where it is performed. There was a guy, I think it was the book writer for the musical Allegiance, came in to speak to my college. And I asked him, I was like, because you have this whole process and this whole Broadway run, when did you feel like the script was done? And he just said, well, to be honest, I don't think I ever felt like the script was completely done. There just got to be a certain point where we're doing a Broadway performance and you kind of have to, for the time being, just be like, this is the version that is going to be up at this point. And so I think that exploration for me is my favorite part of the whole process.
There's a great story, Rodgers and Hammerstein, when they were doing King and I. Now, this is going back already, what is that, 60, 70 years. And during previews, they had noticed that Gertrude Lawrence and Yul Brynner were falling in love, that their relationship as co-stars was getting very powerful. And all of a sudden, it just made them say, you know what we need? And they wrote the seminal number from that show, Shall We Dance, just because they saw the relationship of the two actors blossoming. So it looks like you and your colleagues are taking that same tact. It's like, okay, here are the words. How do we feel about them? Which is really amazing. Is this your first play? Is this the first thing you're doing?
First thing of this scale, definitely. I had a play, my first like venture into playwriting where I was like, maybe I want to do this. I wrote a 2-person play. It was about an hour long that was put up at the Ohio State University at Newark. And they had a little black box theater, mm-hmm. and it was put up for 3 nights. But like in terms of scale and New York City and all these things, yes, this is my first major production.
Is this your maiden voyage in New York?
Yes. I've had a couple one acts in some festivals here and there, but this is my first thing in New York as a full-length play.
Wow. How does it feel? Welcome to New York, young Jedi. How does it feel?
Thank you. There are moments where I'm just like, you know, walking down the street, music playing, like, yeah, this is amazing. And then there are those moments where everything just feels like it's all happening. You're like, hold on, whoa, how did I get here? It fluctuates. And I expect it to fluctuate for as long as I'm doing these things. But it's exciting. Overall, there's amongst all of the feelings of like anxiety and excitement and fear, there is this overall just pure joy. Just I get to play. I get to do these things. And people are going to see it and hopefully be moved by it. And that, to me, is extremely exciting.
That's terrific. I'm glad to hear that. When the first play I'd ever directed, when I finished with it, I said, I will never do this again. I've had enough. This is too difficult. I can't stand New York. I can't stand this. I can't stand it. And I sat down and probably 20 minutes later, I said, but maybe one more. And that was 40 years ago and I haven't stopped. So how do you, let's say in a perfect world, this is a great project, well-reviewed, good audience, blah, blah, blah. What's next? What's next for Max? What play are you writing? What are you going to do? What's right over that horizon?
So I'm working on, I have actually a workshop of another play I wrote going up at my college, like 3 weeks after Treehouse closes.
Oh my. Okay. That's faster than even I thought the answer would be. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I'm excited for that. It's going to be a super, coming right off of Treehouse, it being through the school and through like kind of like a club workshop production, it'll be a super kind of a lot more relaxed of a process. Really, I just want to hear the script out loud and kind of see where I can take it after that. This one is, I wrote a one act that was in a couple festivals. It was in the Players Theater Short Play Festival over the summer, and then it was at the Manhattan Repertory Theater in September.
Oh, very cool.
And the whole idea was that it was this couple that had been split up, and the guy Tucker was like a week after they had broken up, and he was standing in the subway where his ex-girlfriend took to work with a bucket that said, tell me off 25 cents. And so doing this whole kind of like street theater production thing, just to kind of like get under her skin, and the play kind of culminated in this huge argument, and like you learn things about the relationship and how they kind of came apart. And so I took that idea, and I remember I was on the phone with the director of that show, and cause I was back home doing some theater in Ohio, and he was doing some rehearsals in New York, and I was on the phone with him talking about, I think it was like the first rehearsal, and he goes, you have to make this into a full-length play. And so actually it's funny. I had like just finished writing Treehouse, and then I jumped in and started writing the show. And so this one goes in reverse time, and then you see the relationship and how it develops. And it's really, I think that one's really special to me because it's two artists, it's two writers. And so it's kind of that idea of how those relationships can be incredibly beneficial to your creative process and incredibly detrimental all at once. And it's these characters kind of dealing with that.
My last question to you, the common stereotype is that you tell an author or a playwright is write about what you know. You're writing deep things about relationships and about coming together and the good and bad of relationships. Where does this knowledge come from? What makes you aim at those things?
It comes from several places. I think, and I've said this before, I think that for me, something that I've kind of had to discover and learn about myself is that because I think I'm a writer and I have read, you know, since I was little, and I'm constantly giving myself, feeding myself story, you start to develop these expectations that life is going to kind of end up in this sort of story format. And if you see little things looking similar or mirroring how like a typical story, especially like of like a romance story or whatever would go, you start to get these expectations. And when those inevitably don't come true because it's life and not this story, there's a lot of disappointment, a lot of confusion and things that I've had to kind of deal with and confront to learn this lesson. And so I think that in any other story, if this was being told from that kind of typical story perspective, Scout and Winston getting together would be the big ending, the main happy ending of the story. Would be the two of them coming together and like, oh, we loved each other all along. End. Or Winston going off when she goes off to college, and like, oh, now I'm moving on with my life. End. With this story, it kind of is in like an in-between limbo place. And I think that that's where, for me at least, a lot of the more interesting stories happen, is in between what we expect a story to be. And that even those happy endings that seem happy in a moment, there's life after that. And that like, happy endings, and it sounds kind of depressing if you look at it a certain way, but happy endings are temporary, just like unhappy endings are temporary. And so I think that like with this play, it's, and with a lot of the stuff I write, this is just something that comes up in a lot of different ways, just kind of knowing and bringing awareness to the fact that like life isn't a story, and a story is only like a piece of life, and it's really like a bunch of stories that intersect each other. And that's, you know, and that shouldn't, and that should not be seen as a negative thing, but as an actually a really beautiful thing. Wow. If we just kind of stop expecting this sort of perfect cookie cutter story.
You are wise beyond your years. Max, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let our listeners know, my pleasure. I will let our listeners know when and where to see Treehouse of Dreams before it moves on to bigger and better venues. And they should all come and say hello to you because you're someone that they need to get to know. And we look forward to this and several other projects with your name on it coming up. Thank you so much, and have a joyous new year. And here's to a great opening night.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Ciao.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me in this very, very busy top of the new year 2019. Next week, we'll be chatting with Jan Ewing and a host of others regarding their plays opening up, setting 2019 to be a spectacular year for independent theater and independent film. Thanks again. Mary is not with me this week because she's preparing her own entry for 2019. Wait till you hear about I'm So High, her new cabaret extolling the virtues of, are you ready for this, cannabis. That's right. Until it's legal, let's sing about it. Thank you all very much. Have a joyous start of the year, and we'll see you next week.